The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of The Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to The Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Well, we were walking right on the edge of the road, right alongside the roadway, and he came over and he hit us.
Welcome to Crawl Space. I'm Tim, here today with Lance. Lance, how are you today?
I'm doing pretty well, Tim. Thank you. How are you on this fine day?
I am doing pretty well. This episode is a two-parter. It's an emotional two-parter. We speak with a man named John Palmer, who recently lost his wife in a very tragic automobile incident. And I just want to say we're really happy to speak with John and try to help with his mission.
Absolutely. Talk about an interview that I knew was going to be emotional going into it, because this happened very recently, April 21st of 2020. So it's been 17 or 18 months, and you can tell that John counts the days since this has happened. I don't want to get into it too much in this intro, what happened to Katie, because he describes it. I also want to maybe give a little bit of a disclaimer that while it's not incredibly graphic, it's incredibly emotional. It's one of those ones that still hasn't left me. I don't know about you, Tim, but every day I think about this, and I want to reach out to him and make sure he's doing okay. At the very least, it's something to explore in your personal life. Like, think about your family. Think about just what you do on a day-to-day basis, and how fast something like this can just derail everything.
Absolutely. And yeah, I agree. It's really hard not to think about this case and to think about John and Katie and their children when you see your own family. You know, it's definitely a story that will stick with folks, and they need help. They need the word to be spread about this case. There was a grand jury that was held in Grayson County, Texas, and they declined to indict. And I think the Palmers are looking for accountability in this county.
When you go to their website, justiceforkatiepalmer.com, it's all one word. It says there, what do we want? And first line, we want justice. That's it. They want justice. They want the accountability. And they just out of respect for Katie and for her family, for John, for their kids, just hold some accountability, like you said.
And check out justiceforkatiepalmer.com. You can get all their information there. And again, this is a two-part episode, so this will be part one. This will be broken up into two parts. Very emotional interview. I hope you enjoy it. Please share it if you can. That would really help.
And you can go to the Get Involved tab, and it says how you can help. Share Katie's story, like you said. Voice your opinion to Texas state officials. Sign the petition. Ask your favorite content creator to cover Katie's story. So that's sort of our call out to our peers here in this podcasting world. If you haven't covered Katie's story, please get in touch with John. You can contact him directly through the website, or you could email us as well, and we can make the connection for you. And there's a link on that page as well, how to file a complaint against a state trooper to Texas Department of Safety Inspector General. So you can click on that link, and you can file that complaint that is voicing your opinion to the Texas state officials. And one more quick bit of news before we get to the interview. If anybody is in town, in Worcester, in Wormtown, on Saturday, November 13th, the show Death by Incarceration, hosted by Suave Gonzalez and Kevin McCracken, that's a show that's on our Crawlspace Media Network. They will be performing live at the Brick Box Theater in Worcester. Tickets are available via the link in the show notes. You can also check them out on their social media. They'll be posting about that with the link to the ticket sales. Their Twitter is DB Incarceration, so they will have that link in their Twitter and on their Instagram. Again, that's Saturday, November 13th, with special guest Nikki Bell from the Lyft organization, right there in the heart of Worcester, Massachusetts.
Welcome to the podcast, John Palmer. John, how are you today?
Doing great. I appreciate you guys meeting with me. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. First, no real words to express our condolences and just our thoughts. Like, you've been through such an emotional time, and we truly appreciate you being here with us to talk about it and to talk about getting some deserved justice.
Absolutely. And if it wasn't for platforms like the one that you guys have, my voice and those that are fighting for justice, our collective voices wouldn't be heard. So thank you. Really do appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Yeah, of course. I mean, we have this platform, and sometimes on our shows, we'll deviate a bit and we'll have some fun with some episodes that, you know, aren't so justice focused or about people, you know, missing persons or homicides that have gone long cold. But we deviate from time to time, but we always try to come back to these stories because we know the power of the platform. We know that people will listen and people will spread the word. And if you need anything done, the listenership is very responsible in that sense. They'll sign petitions. They'll contribute to a GoFundMe. They'll try to talk to whoever can make some difference in some injustice.
Outstanding.
And big shout out to Amanda Shirley, who connected us, who is fighting for justice in her brother's case. It's amazing, always amazing to me how families and advocates kind of connect behind the scenes and say, talk to these people. And we really say that is a great way to do it as well, because the more people that, the more folks that you talk to, more podcasts or TV news appearances you appear on, it just makes it easier, I think, for even bigger shows to cover the case.
It does. And I hate to use this word exposure, but I think it's a word that has to be used. You know, the more podcasts that we're on, I feel like locally, especially with our district attorney, it can't go on to be ignored. The more exposure that we bring, and the more light that shed on this injustice, surely our elected officials here in Grayson County will have to pay attention.
Absolutely. And this is something that happened to you pretty recently. We're talking April 21st of last year, of 2020.
Yes, sir.
We'll talk about the incident itself, but I really want to know about Katie the person. Can you tell us about her if you're able to?
I absolutely can. She was compassionate and caring. And I really hate using the word was, but compassionate, caring, very intelligent. She taught science at the local middle school. She loved teaching. When it came to biology, I can't tell you how many times we'd be sitting at home on a Saturday, not doing anything. And, she would get us in the car. We go to Hagerman, which is a wildlife refuge, probably 5-10 miles away from our house. and we would be forced to go bird watching. So I don't know if you guys have kids, but trying to get kids that are, you know, 7 to 9 to go bird watching was quite a feat. But she was funny, very, and I've said this before, very family centric. Loved her mom and dad. Talked to her mom every day, saw her mom every day, and talked to her dad every day. She was a good soul, and she was my soulmate.
And she was a science teacher?
She was. She taught over at Scott Middle School. I'm going to tell you a little bit of a long story behind that. Sorry.
Please.
So when she got out of college, we went to the same college in Sherman, Texas, Austin College. And she got her degree in biology and I got my degree in economics. I graduated a year before she did. And she wanted to be a teacher. So that's what she was going to do when she got out. I decided to join the military about a year or two after I got out. So she had just gotten her first teaching job and I got deployed. I was stationed in Mississippi and then I was going to be deployed. And so she had to stop teaching and lost her certificate and basically put her life on hold for four years when I was in the military. And then we had kids. So she raised both Bella and Brandon. And then when they got to be old enough, she started to substitute teach and then eventually went back into teaching. She went back and, had a long-term substitute job over at the high school and then went over to, Scott Middle School where she taught for four years. I believe she was teacher of the year two or three times there. And really connected with her students. She brought a STEM program there and took kids to robotics competitions and loved it. I mean, that's what, you know, there's some people that are born to do certain things. And man, she had just the best personality to be a teacher. The kids loved her and she enjoyed it. So sorry. Long answer to a short question. Yes, she did teach. She was a science teacher over at Scott Middle School.
No need to apologize. That's a it's a good story, and it's also a really good insight into the type of person she was. Because I personally love the idea that, you know, you said that she gave 4 years of her life to, you know, to accommodate your military schedule and then you had kids. But I don't really see it as you tell the story as someone giving part of their life. It's sort of like the compromise you have in a healthy relationship.
Sure.
Because then she goes back to teaching when she's able to. So she understood, all right, well, it's a give and take. I'm going to, you know, we're going to do this now and then I'm going to do my thing later. And then you do your thing later, you know? And I just think it's a real testament to a strong relationship.
Yeah. I mean, we, you know, and, man, our marriage was rock solid all the way till the end. And you can never be prepared for somebody leaving this world the way that she did. Can't. It was so abrupt. Obviously untimely, you know, she wasn't sick or anything, but, our marriage was on a real high note. And, you know, there was COVID going on and she was teaching from home. She didn't have to, I don't believe she had to log in to, teach her students until like 10 or 10:30 or 11. So got to spend time with her in the morning and, I was finding ways to leave work early just to come home and spend time with her and the kids. And so, you know, we had a great marriage and we were married just about 15 years. And those 15 years, probably were better than some people that, you know, were married 40. And I'm just, I'm blessed to have known her for the 20 years that I did. Very blessed to have been married to a person like her for 15.
It's amazing to hear someone like yourself say that you were blessed to have known somebody for 20 years. I find that amazing, because you could fall into, and I'm sure there are times when it was super dark and you can fall into that. And I think going about it the right way, like you said, not looking at so much the tragedy of the loss, but the fact that you had the opportunity to know somebody for two decades, for most of your life.
Yeah. Well, I mean, really don't think that, really don't think I had the option to think of it any other way. I've got two kids, and it could have been really easy to, kind of fall into a hole, but, I've got a great family around me.
I can't, it's so difficult to like have a conversation about something so raw, you know, and it's obviously super emotional and painful. So whenever you need to take a break, like,
oh yeah,
free.
No,
like,
it's fine. Yeah. Sorry.
No, don't apologize.
But, like I was saying, you know, it could have been real, real easy to, go into a downward spiral, but, I've got a really strong family. You wouldn't believe how strong your kids are. But, my kids got me through it. Bella, Bella's my daughter. And, she was always the one to pretty much, it's not what she would tell me. There were certain times where I would tell her if something wasn't going her way that, it's all right. You've been through a lot, just be happy with where you're at. And she told me numerous times that she wasn't going to use anything as an excuse, for a 14, 15 year old kid to say that, that's pretty powerful. So if she's not going to go into a downward spiral, as her father, and as a parent, I can't. And my son, has been there for me. He's very emotionally in tune with what's going on. It was something else, as a parent, you're supposed to be there for your kids, but it was something else when your kids are there for you at such a young age. But again, I've got a real strong family, and this community has been with us and has supported us. And, it's just a testament to the kind of people that are here in Denison, Texas.
Yeah, that's impressive. So your kids showed you some strength.
Absolutely.
And your kids are teenagers?
They are. Yes, sir. 15 and 12.
Okay. And how have they done?
I think as well as you possibly could. That day they were asleep, and my mother-in-law had to come running in our house and tell them what was happening. So you could imagine just the initial shock of that. You're asleep and you wake up to your grandmother telling you that both your parents have been hit, and she doesn't know if they're alive or dead. That's what my kids woke up to April 21st, 2020. They are so strong. It's been 17 months. You would think that I could get through an interview, but sorry. Kids are handling it as well as anyone could. Again, just kind of falling back on the strength of our family. Katie's family is from here. They're all from Denison, Texas. My mom moved up here a while back from Dallas, and Katie's dad lives in Oklahoma, just about 45 minutes away. So very large family presence here. And, you know, they've just been, they've been outstanding.
And I know it's, you said it's been 17 months and it's only 17 months. I mean, it, I wouldn't worry about that. If, again, if you need to take a break or whatever, that's totally cool.
Thank you.
Yeah. And if it is, I know it is painful for you to talk about, but can you tell us what you remember of that day?
I remember everything about that day. So I had gotten up, I'd started to work out in the backyard before I went to work. And the night before, told Katie we had gone to bed at about eight, nine, and told her that I was going to work out and I was going to get up and walk in the morning also. And she said, okay, go ahead and wake me up and I'll go with you. And rolled my eyes. She was not a morning person. So I said, okay, yeah, I'll wake you up. Went into the backyard, worked out, sent her a text message at about, I think I looked on my phone. It was actually like 7:16. And asked her if she wanted to go work out. Of course, got no response. So I went in and woke her up and she said, no, I'm not going to go walk. And I guilt tripped her and said, come on, let's go. You know, you said that you wanted to go, let's go. And she got right up. We went out the garage. I told my son, he was kind of stirring around, and I told him that we were going to go walking. And Katie has never walked with me in the morning. This is the first time that she ever took a walk with me. And my son has gotten up with me before and gone running and walked, you know, up and down the street. Very thankful that he went back to bed. So he went back to sleep, and we live outside the city limits, and we live on a really long road that goes about half a mile, and then it dead ends. So we would go walking down, we would go west down Glenwood, and we normally would go walk. There's a golf course by us. We would normally go walk on the golf course, and she saw it, and there was some dew on the ground. The grass was a little high, and she didn't want to get her legs wet because she was going to come back home and sleep for an hour or so. Kids didn't have to log into class till like 10 or 11. And I think at that time, everybody was logging in, you know, for like 30, 45 minutes. The teacher was giving work, and then, you know, she had office hours. So she said, well, no, let's not go walk on the golf course. Let's just walk down Glenwood, which is the road that we live on. And I'm going to show you where these killdeer are nesting. Again, big into biology. She studied ornithology in college and loved killdeer. So I said, okay. And those are birds that nest on the ground. So we walked all the way down to where there's a housing development on the north side of Glenwood, and there's some undeveloped lots. And she was looking, and we looked all over, and she couldn't see any. And so she said, let's go ahead and turn around. I said, well, let's walk up a little bit more. She said, nah, I want to go ahead and turn back. All right. So we started to walk back, and we got about 3/10 of a mile from where we stopped to look at those killdeer. And we were walking alongside the road. And about that time, that's when Corey Foster hit us with his F-250 from behind. He was traveling from his house, which was just about where we were when we were looking on the opposite side of the road for those nesting birds. He traveled those 0.3 mile, crossed over the roadway, hit us both. Hit us so hard that he knocked us out of our shoes. Sent us approximately 70, 75 feet. And I'm not a small guy. And sent me, I've obviously never been hit that hard in my life. Katie and I were walking, and she would always walk a little bit to my right. And I don't know how many times that I would, you know, as a man, you're taught that, you know, you always walk on the side of the road. I would always kind of tap her on the shoulder, and she was very assertive, and she was like, don't tell me what to do. You know, I'll walk here, and I'm fine. But we were walking right on the edge of the road, right alongside the roadway. And he came over, and he hit us. I knew pretty quick what had happened. It was such a shock. I don't remember feeling the initial impact of when he hit us. I just remember flying through the air. And still to this day, I don't know how we didn't hear him. I mean, he was in a 6,000-pound truck. And I don't know how we didn't hear it. That's the one thing that I keep on going back to. And you always try to come up with some sort of reason of why things happened. And I can't for the life of me understand how we didn't hear that truck. I could hear that truck now with the truck that he drives. I can hear it quarter mile away before he turns on to our street. And Katie would be in our bedroom, and I would be in the living room, and I swear I would have the TV on like 5, and she would text me to turn down the TV. So we did not hear it at all. He hit us. I was going through the air, and I remember thinking that we got hit. I could see his truck out of the corner of my eye as I was going through the air, and it's almost like we were going the same speed. I hit the ground, and I rolled, and got up, and started yelling what happened. At that point, I remember Corey was out of his truck and had told me something along the lines of, I'm sorry, John. I didn't know it was y'all. I was trying to clean my windshield. Those were his words. Those were the two sentences. And that's when I saw Katie. She was, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 feet away from me. I got hit more towards the golf course, and she got hit into the golf course, but more of at a flat line right by a tree. And she was leaned up on her left elbow, and she was looking over me, and she let out this moan that had a lot of pain in it. And at that point, I felt, I was trying to get up to go walk over to her, and I couldn't. It felt like there was a ratchet strap around my midsection, and it was getting tightened. I tried to get up, I couldn't. I crawled over to her, and I laid her down on her back, and I remember telling her it was going to be okay. Everything's going to be fine. I had been yelling for somebody to call the police. At that point, one of our neighbors had stopped. She had gotten out, and she sat right by the top of Katie's head. And I've never met this lady before and never even looked up at her. I never saw this lady's face until I met her on scene, probably 2 months later with the district attorney. I'd never even looked up and saw this lady's face. I just remember hearing her voice, and she was telling Katie it was going to be fine also. I noticed that Katie wasn't breathing, and I was begging for her to breathe, and then she finally started to breathe, and there was short breaths, 10 to 15 seconds in between each breath, like a really like quick labored breath. And I thought to myself, maybe we're going to be okay. Then I looked at her eyes, and her eyes were fixed and they were staring straight up. She wasn't blinking at all. Beg for her to blink. And man, I was trying to close her eyes. I see if she would open them back up, but her eyes were fixed, staring straight up. And I think she was already gone. I think that was her body just trying to hold on. I was told by a family member that somebody at the trauma center that Katie went to said that with the impact with the truck and the way it snapped her head back, that at when her head hit the hood, which there is a massive dent. I don't know if you guys have seen the pictures of the truck, but there is a massive dent on the driver's side of the hood, and that's where her head hit. So her body folded all the way back on the truck. Her head hit, and then when she was projected forward, they said with the amount of swelling that her brain did, that her brainstem snapped. And I believe that when she made that moan that I talked about, I believe that was her soul leaving her body. And I believe that her body was just going through the process of shutting down. The paramedic showed up, in my opinion, in a great amount of time. I mean, I believe they were there less than 10 minutes. I mean, 7 minutes. They got there. They started to work on Katie. I remember hearing them say that they needed to get medical transport for her air. And I saw them working on her. Then they came over to me. They loaded me up. They put me into the back of an ambulance. And then just wanted to know how she was doing. Wanted to make sure that my kids were taken care of. And the last time that I saw Katie that day was when she was getting put on a gurney and I was getting put in an ambulance. And then everything else is pretty much on that body camera footage that we've put on social media.
And how are you doing? How are you doing physically at that time and now?
At that time, I had 4 broken ribs and I had 2 fractured vertebrae. And I was told I had some bruising on internal organs. I was in the hospital, obviously, that day. The next day, they said that they wanted to keep me a couple more days, but they said, you probably won't stay. And I said, you're 100% correct. Left the hospital to go be with my kids and to go say goodbye to her body. But now, physically, I'm fine. I mean, still have some lingering pain in my back and my elbow, but could have been a whole lot worse. And, you know, I'm lucky. Gone through therapy as much as I could. My daughter still goes. I think that whole process will take a while. I don't think that I'll ever get over it. I don't think any of us will ever get over it. We just got to get through it into a point to where when you start thinking about it, you know, it's real easy to let irrational thoughts take over. I just try to keep it as rational as possible and don't ask why. You know, I don't believe there was a reason why Katie was taken and I was left here. I believe that's all free will. We're just trying our best to get through it. So that's the best that we can do.
And we'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors.
Step into the hidden corridors of the past with Hometown History, where every episode uncovers the untold stories and secrets nestled in the streets and alleys of our own backyards. We bring history to life, revealing the extraordinary and the ordinary, from local legends to forgotten tales that shape the communities we know today. Tune into Hometown History and embark on a journey through time, right from where you are. Gather round, friend, and join me by the fire. I have a secret to share. When I was a child, I lived with my grandma. She allowed me to watch Unsolved Mysteries. Fast forward to 2008, my freshman year of college. A series of armed robberies on campus escalated into a serial rapist's reign of terror. That's when I created my first crime podcast. In January 2014, I picked up the podcast again from my college roommate who fell for an underage girl online, to the chilling story of a murdered nun in 1969 Baltimore, and in the Throwaway series, I share my own journey of overcoming homelessness and how that experience led me to unmask a serial killer and identify three of his Jane Doe victims. This is Foul Play Crime Series, where the stories are real and the truth is waiting to be discovered.
Do you find yourself captivated by the inexplicable, entranced by enigmas, and tantalized by the unknown? We are Shane and Josh Waters, brothers who will weave you through tales that have mystified us for years. From haunted hotels to inexplicable disappearances,
our episodes offer you a panoramic view of the world's greatest mysteries, leaving no stone unturned, no clue unnoticed.
With a gripping narrative, we invite you to join us on a journey into realms of the unexplained.
We're unraveling the mysteries that have perplexed humanity for ages.
So, armchair detectives, curious minds, and seekers of the strange, it's time to put on your headphones and dim the lights.
Dive into the uncanny world of the Mystery Inc. podcast and prepare for a journey into the unknown that you'll never forget. And remember, some mysteries are better left unsolved, but not unexplored.
How's it going, everyone? It's Tim and Lance here. Have you ever wanted someone to read you creepy bedtime stories in the most velvety voice ever?
Well, you had me hooked at velvety, Tim. We are excited to share a podcast that is exactly that. It's called Nighty Night Bedtime Stories to Keep You Awake. And Tim, it's narrated by a friend of ours.
That's right. New York Times bestselling author and podcaster Rabia Chaudhry. Nighty Night is an anthology featuring classic horror stories this season and fictionalized true life stories in season one that are so creepy that you will realize reality is scarier than fiction.
And Tim, I know our favorite part of each episode is at the end when Rabia says, but wait, there's more to the story. And we get to hear those fascinating details about the author and the context of the tale. What's your favorite episode?
My favorite episode is The Tiny Hairs from season one, which takes us on a harrowing journey when the narrator runs into a dangerous man in the woods. What about you?
Well, mine comes from the current season. It's called The Horla, in which we witness the protagonist spiral into a descent of madness. Tim, I feel like I'm constantly spiraling into a descent of madness, so I really relate to that one.
Well, I hear that. So dim your lights, get under a cozy blanket, and find and subscribe to Nighty Night wherever you get your podcasts.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Thanks to our sponsors, and now we're back to the program.
So, by all accounts, the individual who hit you and Katie, Corey Foster, he was a repeat offender, correct?
He had a 30-year history of interactions with police. Yes. From unlawful carrying of a weapon to breaking into a building when he was younger to traffic violations as an adult. He had, from what I believe, it looks to be at least two DUIs that were pled down to public intoxication. I believe he had one DUI already. The other two public intoxes, those were, I believe, those were DUIs that just got pled down. Got sent to the DA's office. Corey had a good lawyer. And rather than prosecute him, they went through a plea deal. And that's it. But no, he's had 30-year history of infractions and, you know, speeding, reckless driving, DUI, public intoxication, has never been held accountable once. Never.
Was he given a field sobriety test at the scene?
He was given a field sobriety test approximately 50 minutes after he hit us.
And you said 50, like 50?
50, so 10 minutes short of an hour, yes.
Right.
He was given a field sobriety test. He was given the horizontal gaze test. Couldn't see his eyes in the body camera. Trooper said that he passed that. He walked a line. Trooper said he passed that. He held 1 foot up in the air. Didn't hold it for 30 seconds. Held it for, you know, 23, 24 seconds and was shaking horribly. Couldn't keep his balance, fell down on one side and started laughing. Said that it was his work boots and, you know, that's why he couldn't keep his balance. I want to make sure that you guys know through this whole ordeal that was captured on the body camera by Tarif Al-Khatib, the trooper that was the lead trooper that day. Not once did Corey Foster ask how Katie Palmer was doing. Not once. Never showed any emotion other than laughing twice. After the field sobriety test, which the trooper said that he passed, he then gave him a PBT, a portable breathalyzer test, in which Corey blew a .06 50 minutes after he hit us, which I would assume that any seasoned law enforcement officer would look at that and go, okay, it took me 30 minutes to get on scene, which there's no accountability to what Corey Foster is doing for those 30 minutes before DPS got on scene. And then the trooper was on scene 20 minutes prior to giving him that portable breathalyzer test. So if you did the quick math, you would think that he would be very close, if not over a .08, which is the limit in Texas. And I think at least 4 or 5 times on Tarif's body camera footage, he mentioned the strong smell of alcohol, said he could smell it coming from his breath. Corey told Tarif that he had stopped drinking last night, first at 7, then at 8, then at 9, and then he didn't know when he stopped. And he said he only had 5 drinks the day before, which is, I mean, anybody with common sense would go, there's no way you're going to drink 5 drinks the night before and stop, you know, 10 hours before you get into this incident and still smell like alcohol. And then on one of the other body cameras, everybody that was on that scene, I'll say this, Tarif Al-Khatib knew the type of person Corey Foster was, and some body camera footage that we just got released to us 3-4 weeks ago. I believe that one of the other troopers, David Taylor, probably meant to turn his body camera off, and the officers had a lot of candid conversations. And Tarif Al-Khatib was quoted as saying, as soon as I walked up to the scene and saw it was him, I was like, he's probably drunk. They knew what type of guy Corey was.
He had that reputation?
Absolutely. Yes. Yes. Yes.
And you said that his blood alcohol was 0.06?
0.06, 50 minutes after, yes.
And the legal limit is 0.08. Okay.
The legal limit for intoxication is a 0.08, correct.
Yeah.
What about obstruction of his windshield? He claimed he was he couldn't see out of his windshield, or he was cleaning it?
What he told DPS, which is the Department of Public Safety, which is the de facto state police in Texas. And this was written in Tarif Al-Khatib's report, okay? He said that Foster told him that he couldn't see when he left his driveway and that his windshield was foggy. So instead of putting the defroster on, he drove out of his driveway and traveled 0.3 miles blind, and then said that the sun hit his windshield. And not only was he blinded by the foggy windshield, but he was also blinded by the sun. That's a bullshit excuse. Sorry for the language, but that's just an excuse. The drive from his house, from his mailbox to where we were hit is 38 seconds, going 33 miles an hour, which is at the low end of what the county hired a third party to reconstruct the wreck. Because DPS did not do it. DPS didn't even mark the scene at all. Nothing. So they didn't go take him to go get a blood test. They didn't interview any potential witnesses that were on scene. And they didn't mark the scene. Third-party report said he could have possibly been traveling between 33 and 43 miles an hour. It's hard to determine that because, again, there was no markings. So they really had nothing to go off of other than... We think Katie's body was here. We think John's body was here. And based upon some physical evidence that we saw on the like 15 pictures that they took of the site, which is crazy, just 15. And I'd say 8 of those were of the truck. They determined that he was going between 33 and 43 miles an hour. So I had somebody drive me in their truck and I filmed it and I put that out on social media too. 38 seconds driving blind. And then you cross over the roadway and hit two people smelling strongly of alcohol. And I also want to bring something else up. We got his phone records. Okay. This has not been released yet. Not only was he claiming that his windshield was obstructed by environmental factors, and he was blinded by environmental factors, the foggy windshield and the sun, which according to an independent third party, again, every driver has to deal with that, okay? Stating environmental factors caused a wreck when you had 38 seconds, just 3/10 of a mile of drive time, it's not an excuse. We got his cell phone records. He placed a call to a local number 31 seconds before calling 911. The timeline that we have in place that we've presented to the DA along with these phone records would indicate that Corey Foster was also manually distracted by dialing this number in engaging in the call seconds before he hit us. As he made that call, he obviously already couldn't see. He made that call, drifted over to the other side of the road, engaged in the call, hit us, came to a rolling stop because there were no brake marks. And he came to such a casual stop that the recorder inside the truck did not record his speed. He thought he hit a telephone pole, is what he told state police. He got out with his phone in his hand, saw what he did, made the statements to me. I'm sorry, John, I didn't know it was y'all. And I was trying to clear my windshield. I was yelling for somebody to call the police as I was crawling over to Katie. Corey looked down. He was already outside of his truck, had his phone in his hand. Ended that call, and 2 seconds later, called 911. And we have a witness that drove up, the same witness that came down to come sit by Katie when I had crawled over to Katie and stated that Corey was already on the phone in the middle of the road when she got there. So the DA never requested his cell phone records at all. State police never looked at his phone for distracted driving. The DA told me twice that they would get his phone records. This was once before the grand jury. And of course, they didn't have the phone records for the grand jury. Then one time after the grand jury hearing, they said, we'll look at the phone records and see if there's anything else that we can get. They never requested this. I sent them a Freedom of Information Act request, just asking for any evidence that they did indeed request those phone records, and they would not answer me. And they sent my request to the Texas Attorney General stating that what I was asking for was investigative materials that they could not release because Corey Foster was not indicted. I didn't ask for the phone records. I asked for evidence that they even requested them in the first place. Those phone records were handed over to the district attorney's office approximately 6 weeks ago.